be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is Wednesday, May 17th. The first matter on the calendar for oral argument is State of Minnesota versus David Schaefer and Joseph Hamlin. Counsel, you will each have 15 minutes to make your argument. Counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. It's important that you state your name and identify the party you represent when you begin your argument. And with that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is William Young. I'm an Assistant Attorney General here on behalf of the State of Minnesota's Department of Transportation. In this condemnation case, Joseph Hamlin made a claim for statutory attorney's fees. This was not a civil rights case. This was not a claim for attorney's fees based upon any case where he sought equitable relief or injunctive relief. This case, after MnDOT's petition for condemnation was granted, was solely about the amount of just compensation owed to Mr. Hamlin for the land taken. And after that was resolved, the statute entitles Mr. Hamlin to make a claim for reasonable costs and fees, for his reasonable costs and fees. Mr. Hamlin had a contract with his attorney that established the nature of his retainer agreement for the attorney's fees. And that agreement was a contingency agreement that established that his costs and fees, that Mr. Hamlin's attorney's fees, would be $16,333.33.
But you agree that under the Lodestar analysis, this specific agreement between the lawyer and the party in a particular case is only one of the factors the court considers when determining the reasonableness of attorney's fees, right?
I would agree that under a Lodestar analysis, one of the factors, and before the Minnesota courts have adapted the Lodestar, it was the Paulson factors, is the nature of the fee agreement. But I would note that all of these cases in which the Minnesota courts have cited to the federal courts, they've cited to federal Section 1988 claims. They're civil rights claims where the nature of the claim is actually inherently different. You often have attorneys who are taking these cases that aren't even seeking compensation because they're sort of they're public interest law firms. There are cases where you're seeking to maybe stop some sort of action, to enjoin some sort of action. Here, the only case is the amount of compensation. And so in that case, the attorney and the landowner have the right to reach whatever sort of fee agreement they agree is reasonable on both sides, as long as it complies with Minnesota Rule of Professional Conduct 1.5 for reasonable fee, and that's what happened here. And because the claim is Mr. Hamlin's claim, if $16,333.33 is awarded as reasonable attorney's fees, Mr. Hamlin is made whole. He is fully reimbursed, and Mr. Elger is made whole. The attorney is made whole because he got exactly what he bargained for with Mr. Hamlin. If any amount is awarded above $16,333.33, somebody's getting a windfall here from the taxpayers. And
let me ask you that. I mean, as a practical matter, if the district court's order were to stand, who would get the $63,228 awarded in reasonable fees? Does it matter?
I don't think it matters because either way, it's a windfall being paid to somebody from public funds. But that is a great question. That's one question that we asked the district court during the motion hearing. We argued to the court, if an amount above $16,333 is awarded, somebody's getting a windfall. The claim belongs to Mr. Hamlin, so presumably he gets to keep the funds. There is no entitlement from the two contracts that were provided, the two retainer agreements that were provided, to suggest that any amount of money above that amount is obligated to be passed along to his attorneys, even though it was sought, and the district court made express findings that the fee obligation was only the $16,333. So presumably, Mr. Hamlin would keep the money. But in that case, he's received full just compensation, which is $92,000 in this action for what was taken, full reimbursement of his attorney's fees, reimbursement of his other reasonable costs and expenses that were under 117.031A that weren't challenged on appeal, and then this additional $46,000 of public funds that are just going into his pocket, which doesn't seem to support the interests of the statute, which is to make the landowner whole, not to give him an extra benefit.
What does the statute say the goal is to make the landowner whole?
The statute itself doesn't say to make the landowner whole. The statute says the claim is to the owner. But in this court, in the Vermillion case, the inverse condemnation case, discussed chapters 117 claims and identified that the claimant is the landowner and said allowing only the landowner, not the attorney, to make the claim, it supports the purpose of the statute under chapter 117 to make the landowner whole. So
that was a different section of the statute, though, in Vermillion.
I agree. That's a different section of Chapter 117. That's correct.
Okay. And that really was an issue of standing in the Vermillion case.
It was, but the issue was the same here in that any fee claim here to get back to Judge Bjorkman's question, any amount of money awarded seems like it should go to Mr. Hamlin. It's the owner's claim. There's no contractual entitlement for it to pass along from Mr. Hamlin to anybody else.
So I want to back up because I didn't hear a direct answer to Judge Bjorkman's question, which I had the same thought is, doesn't case law interpret the statute to apply the lodestar method of calculating reasonable attorney fees?
Well, the outset is, let me take that in two parts, Your Honor. So first, the claim is statutory, so the claim has to come from the statute, and the language of this statute awards the claim to the owner. The cases, the Krause case and the Cameron case, in which the Minnesota Supreme Court has interpreted the statute to use the lodestar method, in doing so, the Minnesota Supreme Court just grafted on the Section 1988 federal U.S. Supreme Court analysis to these claims, but didn't, because it wasn't an issue in those cases as to whether the claimant is the owner or the attorney, or if the claim could be for higher than the award of attorney's fees, because in both cases they were only seeking full reimbursement, not above the contractual. Those issues weren't really resolved, but the Minnesota Supreme Court has interpreted other statutes and the U.S. Supreme Court as well, acknowledging that the statutes themselves can place limitations on an award, and lodestar is done after you interpret the plain language of the statute.
But that's, I'm not sure I agree with your interpretation of those cases. All they did was affirm the district court's decision, saying it did not abuse its discretion in its determination of the attorney fee award. I'm still not getting a direct answer to the question, though, is does the lodestar method apply to the statute?
The lodestar method does apply, okay. But the statute itself.
Okay. So the second part of my, it's a multiple part question I have, so I'll just take it in a small bite. So,
sure.
And that's how I interpreted your brief too, that the lodestar method applies to Minnesota statute 117.031 sub A. Is that statute ambiguous at all?
No.
Okay, it's unambiguous. So we just apply the plain language to it.
Correct.
And the plain language says that, quote, the court shall award the owner reasonable attorney fees. And case law says reasonable attorney fees are calculated according to the lodestar method, which takes into account the Paulson factors, right?
Yes.
And one of the Paulson factors is the fee arrangement, but that's only one factor. And the cases have clearly said one factor doesn't trump the other ones. So that's only one factor we look at is what there is. So where is any limitation? Where is there a cap language in 117.031A?
To kind of unpack the questions, a couple steps into your multiple questions here. The statute awards shall award the owner reasonable attorney's fees. So by doing it, it limits the award to the owner. It's not shall award the owner's attorney reasonable attorney's fees. And in doing so, the owner's reasonable attorney's fees can at most be the owner's attorney's fees because
it sounds like you're reading into the statute language that's not there. And you cite to the Vermillion case, and that case interpreted a different section of the statute. And that statute had language talking about reimbursement. And throughout your brief, you talk about reimbursement, but that reimbursement language is not in 117.031A. If the legislature wanted to have it limited by using the word reimbursement, it could have put that language in there, but it doesn't say that. It just says, the district court shall award the owner reasonable attorney fees, which is determined by the district court according to the lodestar method.
Well, if I may respond, Your Honor.
Sure.
Attorney's fees, the reasonable attorney's fees can only be what the landowner's attorney's fees are. Anything above that amount is just, it's a windfall. It's not an attorney fee.
Where is that lodestar, language in the statute?
Doesn't the lodestar already incorporate the possibility of a windfall?
Again, the lodestar, in incorporating the six Paulson factors in the U.S. Supreme Court in analyzing these 1988 cases, discusses contingency fees, the most sort of pertinent U.S. Supreme Court case is the Burlington v. Daig case. And it does talk about that is one factor to do, but in those cases, the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, to be clear, is discussing how the interest here is not to make the landowner whole, it's to vindicate these important civil rights. And so the purpose of the statute is just a completely different statute. There's no, once MnDOT files a petition and the district court grants it, the only issue left is how much just compensation is owed to the landowner. And that's just a fight, I think it gets kind of summarized in the briefs, it's a fight over damages. It's just the landowner thinks I'm entitled to X, the state thinks I'm entitled to Y, and the commissioners decide, is it X, Y, somewhere in between, somewhere above, below. They make that call.
Right, but in the lodestar method, going back to my question, there is an assumption that there might be a windfall, that is a fee that is paid to a plaintiff above what that plaintiff might have had to pay the attorney.
Correct.
On the agreement. So I'm trying to get a, I understand the argument that, well, civil rights cases are different. But, I mean, are they? I mean, who's more aggrieved? A homeowner who, or a landowner who runs the risk of losing more than 50% of the value in his property or her property, or a civil rights claimant who may not have suffered any financial loss at all? I mean, you seem to be valuing one more than the other.
Well, in the one difference, one key difference in these in those two scenarios is that a landowner will have to, or the, sorry, not the landowner, the civil rights plaintiff will have to prove liability. Here, we walk in and we say, we're asking to take it. So they don't have to prove that MnDOT took anything. That goes back to the inverse condemnation cases analyzed in Vermilion. And because this court has already found in Vermilion the purpose is to make the landowner whole, in a direct condemnation case where the landowner doesn't have that burden, that analysis is even more striking because MnDOT, at the start of this case, the start of these cases, has to pay an amount of money the landowner can use to go retain counsel to then seek more compensation. So in this case, at the outset, Mr. Hamlin was going to be paid $42,000 as the state's approved appraisal of value just at the beginning that he could use to go retain an attorney, go do additional work, whereas in a civil rights case, you don't have that initial pot of money. You have to prove liability. It's just a completely different procedural posture at the outset. And because those protections are afforded in Chapter 117 for landowners whose property is being condemned, they're just not similarly situated to a civil rights plaintiff.
But you have a constitutional right that's at issue in a condemnation case.
Correct. It is a constitutional right. It's a Fifth Amendment claim under the Due Process Clause. And Chapter 117 is the procedures followed in Minnesota to vindicate that constitutional right. But in a direct condemnation case, or not but and in a direct condemnation case, the condemning authority is coming saying, yes, we are asking for a court order to authorize there's a public purpose and necessity for this taking. MnDOT wasn't disputing that they were acquiring something. They weren't trying to hide the ball. I mean, they followed the steps.
Right, but they wanted to pay $50,000 less than was ultimately awarded. So, I mean, there was a live issue there. It seems to me that the retainer agreement in this case contemplated a potential fee award. I mean, I'm looking, I understand it's the one-third contingency, but there's also a provision that specifically cites this statute, 117.031, and says, we will represent you in that claim, saying that this claim for attorney fees is also part of this, under such terms as we mutually agree. I mean, doesn't that suggest that the risk of no recovery at all versus recovery of a third plus additional attorney fees was part of this whole agreement between the lawyer and the party?
Correct, Your Honor. That language is in both retainer agreements, and it suggests that there could be an additional agreement to entitle attorneys to some sort of.
So doesn't that suggest that Mr. Hamlin may not have been able to, in fact, retain this lawyer, but for the opportunity to maybe get more than a third if the recovery met the conditions of 117.031?
And, Your Honor, we expressly asked for any and all retainer agreements, and so no additional agreement was provided. And so the district court was correct in finding that the entitlement is just $16,333. There could have been a separate agreement. It wasn't provided. The district court couldn't rely upon it. And so there's no basis to assume that there was any entitlement above the $16,000. Although the initial two agreements do contemplate that, there could be a third agreement. We just were never provided any evidence of such an agreement. And so because there was no evidence, the district court properly found that there was no entitlement above and beyond. She interpreted the contract exactly as written to make the findings as to what the entitlement is. With the remainder of my time, I would note also, beyond what we've discussed today, the district court's order is fundamentally flawed in that she made express findings as to what a reasonable rate is and what the reasonable hours expended would be. And based upon her own findings, her conclusion doesn't comport with those findings. She found 105 hours at most, based upon the Great River case, and $325 an hour as a reasonable rate. When you multiply those two together, you get an award in the low $30,000, which, again, we would argue is a windfall, but still, there's no explanation whatsoever as to why a $63,228 award is reasonable based upon her own findings. It's internally inconsistent, and just it cannot stand on its own because it can't be reconciled. We'd have to do a lot of leaps to figure out how that number is justified.
Didn't the district court just basically do apply the Lodestar method of figure out the hours, what are reasonable hours, figure out the reasonable fee, hourly rate, multiply them, and come up with what is reasonable attorney fees? It's fairly straightforward.
The district court found a reasonable rate, and she found, she didn't find a reasonable number of hours, but she said at most 105. And then when you multiply those two together, it's about half of what she actually awarded. And so that's inconsistent with her own findings, the ones that she made. I see I'm out of my time, so I'll reserve the 5 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel. Counsel for respondent.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Stuart Elger. I'm here on behalf of respondent Joseph Hamlin. May it please the court, this case concerns the state's attempt to impose a cap, a pre-Lodestar cap, on a determination of a reasonable attorney's fee under the fee-shifting statute, Minnesota Statutes 117.031A. That same argument has been rejected by this court, by the Minnesota Supreme Court, and by the U.S. Supreme Court, with which Minnesota appellate courts are aligned on the Lodestar. The district court correctly rejected that argument made to the district court, and Mr. Hamlin respectfully requests that this court affirm the district court. Minnesota courts have routinely rejected the argument that MnDOT is making in this case, that the fee agreement between client and counsel should control the determination of a reasonable attorney's fee. In Paulson, State v. Paulson, the generative case that is often cited for the Paulson factors, in that case, the Minnesota Supreme Court specifically rejected the argument that a contingent fee agreement should control the award of attorney's fees under the reasonable attorney's fees analysis that it adopted.
Did that case involve the sort of multiplier that we're dealing with here, where the application of the plea or the retainer agreement would award $16,000 and the court's award is of $63,000 is so substantially in excess?
In that case, Your Honor, that actually was a case that was brought under a different provision of the condemnation statute. In that case, the condemning authority actually abandoned the condemnation proceeding. And so under the statute at that time, which was 117.16, now 117.195, the owner was entitled to an award of attorney's fees and other costs and expenses associated with defending against the condemnation. And so in that case, Your Honor, the attorney would probably have been entitled to nothing because there actually was no award that was made to the landowner in that case. But the court nonetheless said the contingent fee agreement can't control what reasonable fees would be to the owner here.
Because it would have been zero.
It would have been zero. And that is also true.
But here we're not in that. I mean, what I'm saying is that is not directly on point, as Mr. Young suggests. This is a different case. This isn't a civil rights case where there is, you know, a recognition of incentivizing lawyers to take cases by potentially having above a contingent recovery. But I want to ask you the question that I asked Mr. Young right off the bat, and is that if this, as you urge, the district court's decision is left undisturbed, where does the $63,228 go, and does it matter?
Yeah, I want to be very clear on that. Mr. Hamlin is not getting a windfall here. Under the agreement between Mr. Hamlin and counsel following the determination of the final determination of the award, the agreement between Mr. Hamlin and counsel is that upon an award of reasonable attorney's fees, Mr. Hamlin would receive the full amount that he was obligated to pay counsel, and the remainder would go to counsel for the counsel's work in prosecuting the 117.031A claim, and also the work, of course, that counsel had undertaken and that was not compensated for in the contingent fee agreement. So there is no windfall to Mr. Hamlin, and the district court asked that same question.
Are we sure? I mean, I'm not sure the record's clear on that. In looking at the agreements between the parties, whether Mr. Hamlin would be obliged to pay more or not pay more, depending on the outcome of the contingency or the outcome of the attorney fee fight. What is the evidence in the record to establish one way or the other whether there's any additional obligation, depending on the outcome?
Well, the evidence in the record is a statement of counsel at the district court.
Is that evidence?
Well, it's a direct answer to the question. I don't have a writing that I can point to establishing how that fee will be dispersed, but the agreement is that Mr. Hammond will not receive as a basis of this award more than he's obligated to pay counsel, which is actually more than $16,333. The fee is $18,900 plus Mr. Hamlin paid certain costs, which were part of the award that the district court made that will also be paid to Mr. Hamlin since he advanced those particular costs. He also paid for appraisal fees. He paid for expert fees. All of those fees he's paid, and substantially most of that. It's not under appeal in this matter, and Mr. Hamlin will get an award to recover those fees that he paid. But to answer Judge Bjorkman's question, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter because the lodestar analysis, as is clear in the case law, only makes the contingent fee agreement or the agreement between client counsel one factor that's considered in this circumstance. It doesn't control how much would be paid. So the agreement between client and counsel should not control what would be a reasonable fee here. The judge undertook the lodestar analysis and concluded that reasonable attorney's fees were $63,000, $63,228. And the district court, there's actually no dispute that the district court undertook the lodestar analysis and that the district court's determination of reasonable hours and reasonable rate, which is the basis of the lodestar analysis, was proper.
How do we know that? I'm struggling with the adequacy of the district court's findings of fact. I mean, yes, the court says the 392.1 hours are excessive and unreasonable, and then it cites to our court's decision, Great River, where 105 hours. But I don't see any real finding that 105 hours, nor when discussing the billing rates, other than a finding that the rates in the upper 400s and 600s were unreasonable, and a reference to 325 being more reasonable. I mean, are these findings, and then there's no real show your math. Does that give us enough to really review whether the district court properly applied the lodestar analysis?
Well, the district court cited to the lodestar case law, and the district court said this is the analysis that the district court will apply, and she made determinations about hours and rate. It's true that the findings don't contain a clear mathematical path to get to the number the district court ultimately determined, but neither side is asking this court to remand this matter back to the district court for more findings, more robust findings. But certainly that has happened in the past. In the Cameron, Dakota County v. Cameron case, the Minnesota Supreme Court remanded back for more findings. Certainly was it within the power of this court to do that, but there's neither party has requested a remand for more findings in this case.
Counsel, you mentioned at the beginning of your argument that there's, you know, Minnesota case law and even Supreme Court case law that has directly addressed this issue, but I'm not sure if there's any case that I'm aware of that actually, other than the non-presidential case that it was cited, that directly addresses this particular issue of whether or not 117.03.1A requires a cap on attorney fees. Are you aware of, other than the non-presidential opinion, are you aware of any case law that has actually directly addressed that particular issue?
No, Your Honor. I think that's correct. The one case that's specifically on point that looks specifically at 117.031A is the Great River Resources decision of this court, which is non-presidential. But the case law that has looked specifically at 117.031A for an analysis of how will the courts determine a reasonable award of attorney's fees here, have rejected the notion that the attorney-client fee agreement will control. And in cases out of the U.S. Supreme Court, which have been relied upon by the Minnesota Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court has said explicitly under the Lodestar analysis that a contingent fee award cannot be a cap on an award of reasonable fees. And there's a precedential decision of this court, the Frohenshue case. It's not a 117.031A case, Your Honor, but there was a fee shifting provision under the Common Interest Community Act. This court specifically said that, citing de Bergeron, which is a civil rights case, that the contingent fee agreement cannot be a cap on a reasonable award of attorney's fees. And the U.S. Supreme Court and the Minnesota courts, when applying the Lodestar analysis, have not made the distinction between civil rights cases that the state would ask this court to adopt. The Minnesota Supreme Court has relied on Hensley, which is a civil rights case. Hensley is cited in Krauss. Bergeron, Blanchard v. Bergeron, another U.S. Supreme Court cites to Hensley. In the Daig case was actually, just to make it clear, the U.S. Supreme Court decision in Daig wasn't a civil rights case. It was a Clean Water Act and Solid Waste Disposal Act case, which also had a fee-shifting provision. And the majority writing in Daig said, well, you know, we apply the Lodestar analysis across a broad variety of fee-shifting statutes that arise in different contexts. And that's what has happened under 117.031A. The Minnesota Supreme Court has said we're gonna align ourselves with federal case law on fee shift on Lodestar, and we're gonna specifically apply Lodestar to 117.031A, citing to the variety of Minnesota Supreme Court cases that had adopted Lodestar in other fee shifting circumstances. A great example is the Green v. BW Associates case. That's a Lemon Law case. In that case, the Minnesota Supreme Court, relying on Rivera, which is a U.S. Supreme Court civil rights case, said, you know, that a cap on attorney's fees would be inappropriate in the context of a Lemon Law, where consumers are seeking to vindicate their rights for quality consumer products. And
but
specifically,
part of that analysis was just how much more work goes into establishing the claim. And I think Mr. Young has made a valid argument that the nature of condemnation cases, I mean, this is much simpler. This is just about what is the dollar value of the property that was taken, and that you know, would provide a rationale for handling the attorney fee recovery Lodestar analysis differently.
As Your Honor, as an attorney who practices in this area, I would say that it's not that simple. That it's hotly, these issues can be hotly contested. In this case, and a lot of the contestation, Your Honor, comes in the form of dispute over, well, what happened to the remainder property? There's often a wide gap between what The MnDOT or the condemnor appraisers say was the impact of the remainder property, and what the owners appraisers are saying was the impact of the remainder. And that was the situation here. There was a significant dispute between the impact of MnDOT's taking on the remainder property, and I would say that Mr. Hamlin's case was compelling to the commissioners in this case. He received an award that was 114% greater than MnDOT's final offer before commencing condemnation proceedings.
Can I have you address one other thing? You rely significantly on, or at least in part, I don't know how significantly, but it's certainly prevalent in your argument, the parallel to civil rights attorney fee cases. Can you address whether this court in Vermilion sort of undercuts or defeats that position by making a distinction?
Not at all, Your Honor. The Vermilion decision was based on, the holding in Vermilion was whether an attorney could independent of the owner, proceed to seek an award of attorney's fees and litigation expenses under 117.031A. That was the holding in Vermilion. It doesn't undercut.
No, I'm speaking about the rationale that this court engaged in. In those cases, the private attorney standing is in the shoes of government and advancing the public interest and enforcing the statute, and it goes on and explains the difference. And I understand that the holding is different, but doesn't the principle apply?
As I recall that language in Vermilion, it had to do with the owner's vindication of the owner's rights that there had been a taking, and I would say that same general principle applies to this situation where the issue is the vindication of the constitutional right to just compensation. I don't think Vermilion undercuts that. The Vermilion was I think that language perhaps was directed toward explaining why it's the attorney, why the attorney doesn't have independent standing over the owner. But the fundamental principle that owners whose property is taken are entitled to just compensation is, as the Minnesota Supreme Court has said, is a key constitutional right of landowners. And particularly for landowners whose who are seeking to vindicate that right, whose damages are not huge, this provision gives them an opportunity to have counsel represent them who otherwise wouldn't take these kind of cases just because the amount that they could recover in a contingent fee.
I think you've answered. I don't want to have you go too much further over the time.
Yeah, I'm over my time. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Young, you will have the last word.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'm going to try to tackle a couple of the topics that came up here during Mr. Elger's time, but my notes are a little bit jumbled. To respond to the last discussion that Judge Ross was having first, since it's most recent to my mind, I would note that these claims are very lucrative for landowners' attorneys. You've got examples of Krauss, where an attorney got almost $200,000 for fewer than 80 hours of work. There's a couple other examples in this court file that are cited too, where other attorneys filed affidavits. When counsel takes these cases on a contingency basis, they are running the risk that some cases are going to be a home run and some cases are going to be a strikeout, or in this case, maybe a single. And the purpose of the statute shouldn't be to subsidize and to create a floor so that the attorneys are always having that insurance to catch all of their cases. The purpose of the statute here, it's the claim to the owner. And so Mr. Hamlin's claim here is governed by his contractual basis. I would also
Doesn't that go back to the Paulson factor number 6? It seems like you keep going back to that to rely on that as the sole factor to be considered under the lodestar calculation.
And I would note, Judge Bjorkman asked the question, and I would follow up on the conversation to Paulson, that in Paulson there was no contingent amount because the condemnation was abandoned, much like in Carlson. And so in both cases, the attorney did great work for the landowner, such good work that the condemning authority walked away. So the landowner didn't just get amount of money, they got to keep everything they had. And so under those retainer agreements, it didn't contemplate what would happen in that scenario. And so that's why there was a claim through the statute, it's under quantum merit, which is done by Lodestar.
Isn't your argument really ultimately that we should be relying just on the contingency fee agreement, the agreement between the parties, versus looking at all, or versus the district court looking at all the Paulson factors to determine the Lodestar calculation?
To put it in a nutshell, Your Honor, the MnDOT's position would be the retainer agreement between client and counsel sets a cap, a ceiling, and then Lodestar is analyzed to see how much, if not all of that, is reasonable under Lodestar.
Okay.
Because it's the owner's claim, it can't be higher than the owner is obligated to pay. That would be the argument in a nutshell.
Okay, okay.
And I would note, there was a discussion briefly of the Frauenshoe case. In that case, the client's retainer agreement with counsel obligated the counsel to a contingency amount, and it also left it open for recovery of any fees awarded by the district court. So it was kind of a running number. That number wasn't fixed. In this case, the number was one-third of any amount recovered from the commissioners or by appeal. So it was fixed at $13,333. That number wasn't going to go higher as a result of the motion, whereas in Frauenshoe, that number kept increasing based upon the client's agreement. So it was not an equal comparison. Check my notes here for a moment. Again, also in Green, as Judge Berkman discussed, that was another case, much like the civil rights cases or the cases involving landfills like DAG, in which the plaintiffs had to prove liability. That's not the case here. MnDOT walked in and said, we're trying to take your land. We're trying to pay you just compensation for that.
Can you address argument that Amicus has presented to us that the state is essentially taking two different positions here? One position here, in distinction to the position held in the Cross case.
And I would respond the same way I just answered Judge Reyes's question, where because the claim is the owner's claim, the statute imposes a cap at owner's full obligation to pay, and then you apply Lodestar to that cap. That would be the same position that was argued in Kraus. Cameron wasn't a MnDOT case, but the same position. In neither Kraus nor Cameron was the landowner trying to recover more than they were obligated to pay. They were just trying to recover the full amount. And the appellate courts said, no, Lodestar needs to be imposed, a Lodestar analysis needs to be governed onto that full amount to determine how much of that is reasonable. Neither case looked for an escalator, like in this case, where they're looking to recover above and beyond what the contingency amount was.
Do you believe this is a case of first impression?
The only case that's on point is the Great River case. That was a non-precedential case, Your Honor. So there is no published case on point.
So that's the only case that actually has addressed this particular issue?
It does. And in the analysis in Great River, it doesn't really do much analysis. It just sort of, it says this seems to be fine, but it doesn't really provide an explanation. And so I think a precedential opinion explaining how the statute should be interpreted in situations in which the fee claim may be lower than the attorney's time expended, and also explaining if there is an award above and beyond that, who gets it? Back to Judge Berkman's question.
I think Judge Hallbrooks in that case did a pretty good job explaining the case law and how it all fit together in the analysis there, including how to apply the Lodestar method and the Paulson factors based on Cameron and other precedents, right?
And I guess the opinion does discuss this exact factual pattern, yes, Your Honor. What I'm saying is I don't know if it was fully briefed by the parties to have this exact discussion we were having today.
Okay.
And so that's why I think a precedential opinion to help clarify would be nice. I see that I'm out of time, so the state would ask you to reverse and remand for an entry of judgment of the $16,333 found by the court, but if not for that, remand for at least some more clear findings to figure out what should be paid. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both for your helpful arguments. We appreciate it. A very interesting case. We will take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period.